This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello, welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Douglas Impoga, and here is what's coming up.
All UNHCR operations in Sudan's neighboring countries impacted by this new emergency already have existing large refugee and IDP populations and are also severely underfunded.
That's UNHCR spokeswoman Olga Sarado on concerns that Sudan's growing displaced persons crisis will continue to grow and spill over into neighboring countries that already are hosting large refugee populations. Also, 11 opposition women lawmakers are arrested while protesting police brutality. And the Basketball Africa League got its latest round of games started yesterday. All this and more coming up on Africa News Tonight. The Intergovernmental Authority on Development, IGAD, United States, Britain and the UN are among the nations and organizations trying to persuade the warring parties in Sudan to extend their 72-hour ceasefire, which ends tonight. The ceasefire has allowed thousands of people to flee conflict areas and to get food, water and other supplies. The truce was the first hold since fighting began on April 15th between the national military run by General Abdel Fattah al-Burhani and the rapid support forces led by General Mohamed Hamdan Daglo, or Hamiti. Today in Washington, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres met with U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken. They told journalists they are working closely on a number of world crises, including the violence in Sudan. Here is Secretary Blinken.
We're working very closely together to deal with the crisis in Sudan, hopefully working toward more enduring ceasefire, cessation of hostilities, and helping put Sudan back on the track that it was on to civilian-led government, while dealing with, I think, an increasingly challenging humanitarian situation there.
Blinken said the U.S. also is working intensely on food security, climate change mitigation, and achieving development goals. Guterres said the support of the U.S. has been vital to many of the crises the UN is addressing, especially in Sudan.
But I wanted to particularly to express my gratitude and appreciation for the cooperation we have had recently in Sudan. Both Secretary Blinken and myself were trying to broker ceasefires, but successive ceasefires, in both cases with some success, but not the success we would like to have. And I want to express my gratitude for the support that U.S. Security Office have given to the important operation of relocation that we did. A convoy of 1,200, both staff members of the UN, but also NGOs and different missions, from Khartoum to Port Sudan in the middle of a very difficult situation.
Despite the ceasefire, people in Sudan report sporadic fighting around the country. The UN Refugee Agency is appealing Sudan's neighbors to keep their borders open to people seeking safety and protection. The UNHCR warns another displacement crisis could further destabilize an already fragile region. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Since fighting between the Sudanese army and paramilitary rapid support forces erupted April 15th, tens of thousands of Sudanese have been forced to leave their homes in fear of their lives. UNHCR spokeswoman Olga Sarado says the fighting looks set to trigger more displacement inside and outside the country. She says efforts are underway to scale up assistance for those fleeing across borders.
The humanitarian impact of this crisis will be harsh. Before this crisis, Sudan hosted more than 1 million refugees and 3.7 million were internally displaced. All UNHCR operations in Sudan's neighboring countries impacted by this new emergency already have existing large refugee and IDP populations and are also severely underfunded.
At least 20,000 Sudanese refugees reportedly have fled to Chad from Darfur, one of the regions in Sudan most affected by violence. Their arrival is placing enormous strain on the country's overstretched resources. Chad already shelters more than 400,000 Sudanese refugees from previous conflicts. Large numbers of Sudanese also reportedly are arriving in Egypt. So far, the UNHCR has registered at least 4,000 South Sudanese who have been forced to prematurely return home. The UNHCR representative in South Sudan, Marie-Hélène Vernet, says much larger numbers of unregistered people have been rushing through the northern borders with Sudan. Speaking from Juba, she says most of the South Sudanese refugees have fled the Sudanese capital, Khartoum, which is most affected by the fighting, and are returning home to a situation of deep uncertainty.
We 800,000 South Sudanese refugees in Sudan, an unknown number of South Sudanese still in Sudan. Many of them will be coming back to the five northern states in South Sudan that are already extremely fragile, a mixture of conflict, climate change, and food insecurity.
Vernet notes the five northern states depend on the pipeline from Sudan to get food and basic goods into their villages. This, she says, is raising concerns about the impact on communities if a large number of South Sudanese refugees return, particularly in areas of conflict or affected by climate change. She adds 75% of South Sudan's population of almost 12 million depends on humanitarian assistance. She warns a large, unplanned number of new returnees may destabilize already struggling local communities. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Reporter Sid Ahmed Abraham has gone to the land port in Khartoum to talk with people trying to get public transportation out of the city. Here are some of the comments he collected.
أنا اسمي رفيع محمد مسافر من الخرطوم إلى كوستي نسبة للسيولة الأمنية في السودان.
Al-Farah Mohammed says he's traveling to the city of Kosti because of the security in which Khartoum lives, and we have suffered enough. He lives in the Al-Hamrat neighborhood near armed clashes, but thank God for this short truce. He says tickets are very expensive and difficult to obtain. He waited several hours to get one. He has a car, but can't use it because there's no fuel. Shadia Abdel Rahman says she also is going to Kosti because circumstances have changed. She says they are living in insecurity, so they decided to leave because they have children. We'll go to some of our relatives in Kosti. Rahman says if the situation in Khartoum improves, they will return because our homes, cars, and other things are in Khartoum. So we are between two difficult choices, traveling and staying. But they are worried about the expensive ticket prices and the risk that evacuees may be exploited on the road. The UN, United States, and other governments are calling for the warring sides to extend the ceasefire to allow aid to reach civilians who have been living without electricity, food, water supplies for nearly 2 weeks. Meanwhile, Chinese Foreign Ministry says Navy ships sent to rescue the country's citizens from Sudan also evacuated nationals from five other countries. Many nations have scrambled to evacuate embassy staff and citizens by road, air, and sea from Sudan, where fighting between the army and paramilitaries has killed hundreds and led to acute shortages of water, food, medicines, and fuel. The French news agency AFP says rescue operations have intensified since a 72-hour ceasefire took effect on Tuesday. But some fighting was reported around Sudan on Thursday, as well as airstrikes in the capital Khartoum. It's the third time that the Chinese Navy has sent warships to carry out an evacuation mission abroad following operations in Libya in 2011 and Yemen in 2015. China says it's Sudan's largest trading partner, with more than 130 companies investing there by mid-2022. You'll find updates on the Sudan situation on all VOA news programs and voaafrica.com. Mm-hmm. You're listening to Africa News Tonight. I'm Douglas Impoga in Washington. For more information on these and other stories from the continent, please see voafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. For world news, check out voanews.com. Eleven female lawmakers were arrested in Uganda during a protest over alleged police brutality. Halima Athman reports from Kampala.
Dressed in black, the opposition legislators took to the streets Thursday morning to voice their dissatisfaction over what they are calling a violation of the rights of women and a threat to their lives, which they say also violates the Constitution. Scuffles erupted between the women and police as the legislators tried to make their way to the Ministry of Internal Affairs. One of the legislators, Joyce Wagala, detailed some of the women's grievances. She says that during a recent Women's Day event, one of her colleagues was roughed up by police.
Susan Mugabe was beaten, was tear gassed. There were bullets fired. Her sister was beaten, fondled by police officers, almost undressed her. Her mother was also arrested ahead of the celebrations. Her father was locked in the house. So all these violations.
Wagala also says she herself was tear gassed and blocked from holding Women's Day celebrations in her constituency. Police officials were not readily available for comment. They were meeting with the Speaker of Parliament at the Central Police Station where the legislators were being held. The female opposition legislators are asking for Parliament and the Internal Affairs Ministry to acknowledge that the actions of security officers in blocking Women's Day celebrations were illegal, irrational, and an affront to the right to associate and assemble. They also want all local district authorities involved in the assault on the legislators to be individually prosecuted before courts of law and security agencies to be restrained from blocking any other meeting or assembly permitted by law. Halima Othmani for VOA News, Kampala.
According to local reports, the legislators have since been unconditionally released following an engagement between police leadership and the speaker, who told the former that they ought to inform her office first when it comes to the arrest of members of parliament. South Africans of all races are celebrating the 29th anniversary of Freedom Day, a public holiday marking the country's first democratic elections. The day is mostly associated with the black majority who were disenfranchised under the apartheid regime. However, another group, Chinese South Africans, were also denied voting rights under apartheid. Today they remember the joy and excitement of the first time they were allowed to vote, in this story by Kate Bartlett from Johannesburg.
Over a four-day period in April 1994, the world watched as millions of South Africans formed massive lines for their chance to make history. They were about to cast their ballots in the first elections where all races were allowed to participate. Prior to that, under the racist apartheid system, only members of South Africa's white minority could vote, disenfranchising not only the black majority, but all other non-whites, including the country's small Chinese population. Francis Lai Hong, now 64, is the vice chairman of the Chinese Association in Johannesburg. He told VOA he'd stood in line for hours at a school hall to cast his vote.
I can remember quite fondly, as though it were yesterday, the first time we were allowed to vote in South Africa. You know, the Chinese have been here for almost 300, 400 years, and this was the first time we were able to vote in our own country.
The very first Chinese came to South Africa as convicts in the 17th century, followed by indentured labourers in the 19th century. In the late 1880s, Chinese started migrating to the country as part of the gold rush, only to find they were banned from mining. Other barriers in place because of their race affected their ability to trade. Under the apartheid system that began in 1948, the Chinese were classified as a subgroup of the coloured group, a racial categorization that lumped together anyone who wasn't black or white. The electric atmosphere the day he could finally vote 29 years ago is ingrained in Hong's mind.
I can remember the camaraderie and the good-naturedness of the people of the other races that had also never been able to vote before, that were standing in the queue And everybody was so filled with joy and anticipation and expectation and hopefulness of a new South Africa and a new democracy and perhaps a new future, a bright new future for all of us.
Retiree Vernon Hong, no relation of Francis's, is the son of immigrants from China's Guangdong province. His father was a stowaway on a ship to South Africa in the 1950s, and his mother came via Macau through Mozambique and on to Johannesburg. He was 27 when he went to vote for the first time.
It was quite a exciting experience for me that I've now been given the privilege of then voting for the new government.
That's how Vernon Hong felt at the time, though he has since become somewhat disappointed with the route his country has taken. The government is plagued by allegations of corruption, and South Africa is experiencing high levels of unemployment. Jackie Lai, whose grandmother immigrated to South Africa, grew up in the Eastern Cape province in a town with just 5 Chinese families. Now she works in human resources. She was in her late 20s and traveling to Europe when the first elections were held, but still made a point of casting her absentee ballot.
I went on my own on the train to London and walked down to Trafalgar Square and stood in the queue. And it was a strange feeling to be standing in London, realising that this was potentially the first time that I was going to be able to vote.
Lai said she always remembers this now when she votes and appreciates what a privilege it is.
I think that part of the voting was an acknowledgement that we were part of a country and we could contribute equally to that country where we'd actually settled.
Things have changed a lot for the Chinese here since the dark days of the apartheid era. Now, as well as having the vote, a handful of Chinese South Africans have even run for office in the democratic Rainbow Nation. Kate Bartlett for VOA News, Johannesburg.
If you are in Sudan witnessing events taking place there, or if you have family you are talking to there, you can call us on WhatsApp and let us know how things are going there. Dial the international code +1, then 202-258-3076. The number again, the international code +1, then 202-258-3076.
Rwanda's President Paul Kagame heads today for a 2-day visit to Tanzania, where he will meet with President Samia Suluhu Hassan. Local media report no particular agenda has been disclosed, but tensions have been smearing between Rwanda and the Democratic Republic of Congo, both of which share borders with Tanzania. The DRC President, Felix Tshisekedi, the United Nations and some rights groups have accused Rwanda of backing at least one of the dozens of rebel militia groups fighting in the eastern DRC. Rwanda has denied those allegations repeatedly. Sami Ruhuza is a Tanzanian political analyst. He tells me that the friction between Rwanda and DRC is sure to come up during Kagame's visit.
So far, we don't know the purpose, and I think they'll be discussing about the, what's going on in Congo, DRC, the war between Kagame and Tshisekedi, because I cannot call it Rwanda and DRC. I can put it in that way, that Tshisekedi against Kagame himself. I think they'll be also talking about the business ties, the economic ties between Tanzania and Rwanda. For the time being, as we know, Tanzania is having a port, Dar es Salaam port, and Kagame, Rwanda, opted to use Mombasa port. So I think they will also be discussing on those agendas on how to improve the port, the border post, especially Rusumo port. And maybe, I'm not very much sure, maybe they'll also be talking about the power, the image power, the Rusumo Falls. There's a project there, the Rusumo Basin, which Rwanda is also involved. I think they'll also be discussing on that agenda.
Tanzania seems to be becoming a regional player. How do you think Tanzania could help in the friction between Tshisekedi and Kagame?
I'm not very much sure on that because the leaders themselves, they know really what's going on in Congo, but they're not known to the people. They should first identify the cause, because Kagame is talking differently to what Tshisekedi talks. they should come to the point notifying us the source of the war among themselves. But once we know the source, then it will be easy. Because the M23, they're fighting and they have the big equipment. Where are they getting them from? They must have a supplier who is outside Congo, because Congo is a landlocked country, especially in Goma. Where are they getting the tools? They should also identify who is behind the war, who is benefiting out of the fight. So I think the leaders themselves, they know, but they don't want to make it public for everyone to know.
So in your view, this visit may bear some fruits, or what do you think?
Hopefully, because they are also East Africans. So in one way or the other, they will benefit. Now, I think everyone should concentrate on the peace among themselves. The peace in Rwanda, the peace in Tanzania, the peace in Congo, East African countries, they should also enjoy the peace. If there's anything, any problem, they should sit down and discuss and come to the conclusion that will be meaningful than what they're doing now.
That was Samir Huza, a Tanzanian political analyst. He spoke with me from Kigoma in DRC. The European Union today said any deal on microfinance assistance for Tunisia would be conditions on the nation closing an agreement with the International Monetary Fund. A spokesperson for the Commission said if the ongoing discussions between Tunisia and the IMF bring about an agreement, it would allow the EU Commission to potentially provide aid. Reuters news agency reports that the EU's top migration official is visiting Tunisia today to discuss the joint fight against trafficking of migrants and illegal migration. The annual conference of Season 3 of the Basketball Africa League opened yesterday. Host Egypt's Al Ahly dominated Mozambique's Ferroviaria de Beira 92-74 at the Hassan Mustafa Indoor Sports Complex in Cairo. VOA's Jackson Mvunganyi wraps up the action.
Al Ahly got the first point of the game up 4-0, but then Beira's Nomar Madi came through with a three-pointer from the corner.
It's a beautiful bucket there from down in the corner.
6 minutes to go in the first half and down by 12, Mozambique's Nomar Madi finds Mungwambe, who misses but gets the rebound by the basket and scores.
Offensive rebound and a fine score there coming from Ayad Mungwambe.
With 1 minute to go before halftime, Egypt's Tarek makes a quick pass to Omot, who gets it back to Tarek, who finds Kamara for a three, extending their lead. Down by 18 in the third, Beira's Perry scores two for his team and gets fouled on the play.
Oh, that's a beautiful score from Perry as well.
With Beira still trailing in the fourth, Egypt's Abol Nasser finds his way to the basket and makes two off the glass, and they lead by 20 points. The last play comes as Egypt's Orabi passes to Kamara, who tries a three and misses, but they don't need it as El Ahly takes the first game by 18 points in the opening game of the Nile Conference in their own city.
That was my colleague Jackson Mvunganyi with the highlights of the opening game of Baal Tournament's Nile Conference. And check our voafrica.com and the Sunny Side of Sports for all the Baal action. And don't miss our Baal podcast, Nothing But Net, with Sunny Young and Mokbe Oyebro. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Douglas Impuga in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent, 24/7, visit our website at voafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbe Oyebro, and our engineer tonight, Kayla Williams, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
VOA Africa is your trusted source for news, sports, entertainment, and music. Stay engaged with VOA Africa. We love to hear your voice. You can call us 24/7 on WhatsApp and leave a message. Leave comments, requests, or greetings. We may play your message on VOA Africa. Dial the international code +1 then 202-258-3076. VOA Africa is always happy to hear your voice. The number again is the international code +1, then 202-258-3076.